Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to your Holistic Approach to Breast Health and Breast Cancer teleconference and webinar. All lines have been placed on a listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments following the presentation. If you would like to submit a question or comment at any time during the webinar, you may use the chat box located on the lower right-hand side of your screen. Simply type your message into the box and click on the Send button. If you should require assistance throughout the conference, please press star 0. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Shira Dubitsky. Ma'am, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Melinda, and good evening, everyone. My name is Shira Dubitsky, and I am the clinical supervisor at Sharsheret. I'd like to welcome you to Sharsheret's national teleconference, The Whole Picture, A Holistic Approach to Breast Health, and to listen to the teleconference over the phone, please dial 888-479-6525. Joining us tonight are those of you who are at high risk of developing breast cancer or ovarian cancer. Some of you may already have been diagnosed and currently undergoing treatment, and many of you on the line are post-treatment for many years. We have family members, healthcare providers, and collectively, we have over 100 participants representing many states across the country. Sharsheret, Hebrew for chain, is a national non-for-profit organization supporting young women and their families of all Jewish backgrounds who are facing breast cancer. We support young Jewish women facing breast cancer at every stage, before, during, and after diagnosis. We're helping women connect to our community in a way that feels most comfortable, taking into consideration their stage of life, diagnosis, treatment, as well as their connection to Judaism. We also provide educational resources. We offer specialized support to those who are facing ovarian cancer or at high risk of developing cancer. This year, we are celebrating our 10-year anniversary. We have developed 11 national programs that serve women, family members, friends, and the Jewish community at large. We are proud to be the go-to organization for Jewish women and their families facing breast cancer and ovarian cancer. Over the 10 years since Sharsheret's founding, women have been asking, well, what else can I be doing to help myself heal? Are there natural resources that I should be exploring? Should I be changing my diet and exercise routine? We received an email from Hannah who shared, sometimes I lay awake at night and think about additional ways that I can move toward healing that will complement the treatment that I am already undergoing. It seems like there is so much out there. The responsibility to choose correctly and act on everything can feel overwhelming. Well, Hannah, we hear you, along with all the other women who are asking these very important questions and looking for a more holistic approach to healing. It is the Jewish imperative to choose life, and we are charged to go to great length in pursuit of health. Judaism addresses the importance of caring for our minds, bodies, and souls collectively. When someone in our community is ill, we recite the Mishu Berach prayer, which is the Jewish healing prayer, in the hope for a complete healing of the body and soul. There are extensive writings about the holiness of food and the importance of proper nutrition. Though holy, the typical Jewish diet may not fall under the category of proper nutrition. The kugels, heavy meats, wines, and latkes are typically found at our Sabbath and holiday tables. They may not necessarily be the healthiest of choices. The good news is that we are seeing many more Jewish-style cookbooks that are reflecting healthy cooking. There are many Jewish commentators who are addressing the use of natural remedies that can complement medical treatments. So again, walking into a health food store, we are seeing more and more vitamins and supplements that have a kosher symbol. Exercise, physical movement, good sleeping habits are also strongly valued and are extensively discussed, and all of these things are contributing to a sound mind and body. Also, mindful meditation, yoga, or prayer are other activities that women can undertake in order to heal physically, emotionally, spiritually. Now, for some of you, changing lifestyle habits such as nutrition, exercise, and engaging in mindful meditation are really easy next steps in the pursuit of holistic health. But there may be some of you who feel similarly to Hannah, whereby you know that there are complementary interventions, but may feel overwhelmed with the responsibility of making the right choices or any choices at all. First and foremost, it is critical when making any changes to lifestyle or opting for complementary and holistic interventions to always consult your medical team. Some natural remedies or nutritional choices may counteract with your medical treatments. Also, consult an expert when deciding on an exercise regimen. Speak with your rabbi or spiritual leader about prayers or meditations that will fill your soul. And finally, it's important to pace yourself as you make lifestyle changes. Healthy healing means finding the right balance in the three realms of mind, body, and soul. Ushmartem et nashotechem. Guard your health and well-being. This includes your emotional health. Sharsheret is a resource that provides emotional support from a Jewish perspective. There are many women who are calling Sharsheret, and they share that they're having difficulty turning to others for help. And in fact, I had one woman share that she was always the giver and was having a hard time taking. So I told her that in all my years of working at Sharsheret with Jewish women, I never received a call from a woman who said, you know what, this is going to be great. I'm always the taker. I told her that every woman seems to be the giver. So if every woman's the giver, who's doing the taking? Someone has to take, and it looks like it was her turn. As Jews, we are taught that every person must be responsible for his fellow man. A woman at high risk of developing cancer or diagnosed with cancer seeks the assistance of caregivers, doctors, and nurses to heal. But they also are in need of support from the community. Women are supporting each other through Sharsheret's Link program. The community is supporting women through generous donations in order to continue growing Sharsheret's programs and resources. And tonight, we can fulfill this obligation with prayer and well wishes for a complete recovery. Tonight, our goal is to explore complementary interventions that address your overall well-being. Our esteemed panel of speakers will focus on integrative cancer therapies, nutrition and movement, and we will have a question and answer session following the presentations. So it's now my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Gaynor. Dr. Gaynor is well known in the media as an integrative medical specialist and is frequently called upon to discuss such topics as nutritional aspects of cancer prevention, complementary cancer therapies, the dangers of carcinogens in health, and spirituality and healing. He has been featured in many national newspapers, including the New York Times and USA Today. He has also been a source for articles in many national magazines, including Newsweek, GQ, and Healthy Living. His appearances on television and radio are extensive. He has appeared widely on television, including CBS Evening News with Dan Rather, ABC Good Morning America, Fox News Channel, and CNN Your Health. Dr. Gaynor is founder and president of Gaynor Integrative Oncology. He is the assistant attending physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell Medical Center, and clinical assistant professor of medicine at the Weill Medical College. He has held the position of director of medical oncology at the Strang Cancer Prevention Center, where he still serves as a consultant. He is also the former medical director and director of medical oncology at the Weill Cornell Medical Center Institute for Complementary and Integrative Medicine. He has served on the executive review panel at the Department of Defense, Alternative Medicine for Breast Cancer Sector, and the Smithsonian Institution Symposium on New Frontier in Breast Cancer and the Environment. Dr. Gaynor is also the best-selling author of four books and a CD focusing on healing, health, and the environment, and cancer prevention. Dr. Gaynor, welcome.
Thank you, Shira. It's wonderful to be with you all because this is a subject that affects each of us at every point in our life because we're living in a country today where 1 in 3 Americans are going to hear the words, you have cancer, at some point in his or her life. And one of the things that I really want to begin stressing is that there is so much each of you can do to lower your cancer risk. Even if you've already had cancer, there's a lot you can do to avoid a second cancer. There's a lot you can do to reduce your risk of a recurrence. So a lot of times patients will ask me, well, Dr. Gaynor, isn't it too late for me? I've had a high cholesterol for decades. Perhaps I've been overweight for decades. I haven't really taken care of myself. I've already had cancer or a heart attack. Isn't it too late? And my answer always is, it's never too late. And the reason it's never too late is because there are still so many things you can do to strengthen every system in your body. And I think one of the biggest advances in cancer research today is understanding the causes of cancer, things that we can measure that each of you should know, and what you can do about it. So we now know, for instance, if a woman feels a lump in her breast one day and goes to the doctor, has a biopsy, and finds out she has breast cancer, that cancer didn't start when she felt the lump. It may have started decades before, when the first environmental toxin created the mutation that led to the cancer, and there are a number of things that helped promote that cancer. The first is inflammation. And inflammation is one of the biggest promoters of cancer. And so we all know about inflammation. If we get a cut, we notice the redness from the white blood cells reacting in the skin. But there are a number of other things that create inflammation. One, people who have a lot of allergies, whether they're food allergies or allergies to pollen, that creates an inflammatory state in the body. And there are a number of chemicals that are released called mediators that can promote cancer when there is underlying inflammation. People that have irritable bowel syndrome, or worse, Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, that's a chronic inflammatory state that puts those patients at a higher risk of developing a variety of cancers. We know that there's inflammation from environmental toxin. Say secondhand cigarette smoke, or if you happen to smoke yourself, pesticide residues, herbicide residues in food, even the fumes from buses and cars, all those can create an inflammatory state in our bodies. And so it's very important that you know about things that can reduce inflammation in your body. Things like fish oil, for instance, the omega-3 fatty acids in fish oil. There are also omega-3 fatty acids in flaxseed. There's omega-3 fatty acids in pumpkin seed. These are all ways of reducing inflammation. There's a supplement called N-acetylcysteine. That's very important also in inflammation. Then there's what we call oxidative overload. That means that when you're exposed to too much caffeine, environmental toxins, you're creating something called free radicals. And these are another type of toxin that actually can damage the DNA, which can eventually lead to cancer. And so having these environmental toxins is something that it's not possible to avoid. You can try by eating organic, eating as pure a food, as little processed food as possible, but still you're living on a very polluted planet. We aren't living on the same planet that our grandparents were living on. There are all sorts of carcinogens, from mercury to arsenic to the pesticides and herbicides I talked about, to things in plastics like BPA. So people have to be able to protect themselves against those things. Then one of the most important things is what we call glycemic overload. That means sugar overload. And we know every time you eat refined sugar, meaning white sugar, and cookies, and cake, and ice cream, your pancreas has to metabolize those by making insulin. Every time your pancreas makes insulin, your liver's making something called IGF, or insulin-like growth factor. That's one of the strongest promoters of breast cancer and other cancers that we know of. So that's the reason why with every 10% above her ideal weight a woman is, her risk of breast cancer goes up substantially, because the higher your weight is, the higher your insulin-like growth factors are. So you want to really minimize white sugar and white flour. Then there's something called methylation. There are methyl groups that can help protect our DNA. Those are found in green leafy vegetables like kale, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower, and cabbage. And then there's detoxification. Your body's first line of defense from all those toxins I just mentioned are something called detoxifying enzymes. Those are found in every organ system in your body. They help your body excrete these toxins. But they're most abundant in the liver, and they're dependent on various nutrients. So there are a number of nutrients that can increase your body's detoxifying enzymes. These include nutrients like garlic, like the spice rosemary, like turmeric, which is what gives curry its yellow color, like resveratrol, which is found in the skin of red grapes. So these are all very important things you can do to reduce your risk of cancer or to lower your risk of a recurrence, even if you've already had cancer. If we could go to the next slide, it's very important to understand that medicine is a science. I use that science. I use the best that medical science has to offer in terms of chemotherapy, in terms of the targeted therapies like Herceptin and Avastin and a number of the newer targeted therapies, bone marrow transplantation, radiation, and surgery. But medicine is also an art, as Maimonides taught. And part of that has to do with understanding more from our heart as well as with our intellect. And what I mean by understanding with the heart is something that I've really learned from my patients. And I've learned that by over 25 years hearing from literally thousands of patients that told me that in retrospect, having had cancer was the best thing that ever happened to them. Now, how could that be, that cancer could be the best thing that ever happened to them? It was because they were able to learn how to live each day and cherish each day, not let one day go to waste with worry or anxiety. And when you have that, it is almost worth it in retrospect to have gone through an illness like cancer. And there's an oath that every doctor takes when they graduate from medical school. It's called the Hippocratic Oath, the third line of which says, "I will keep pure and holy both my life and my art." And what this is really meaning is that it's very important to look all the time when there's adversity in our life at what the blessing is here. What can you learn? What is, you know, the good part from going through this? And there are always those things if we'll just take the time to look. And also to look at sound as a vehicle to peace. And when I talk about sound, I'm talking about all different types. It can be music. It can be prayer. It can be being in nature. It can be walking on a beach and listening to the waves. Anything that's reminding you of the possibility of being peaceful. And just as any architect will tell you that the most important part of a house is the foundation, the most important part or the foundation of healing is to be peaceful. Next slide. So there are two words that we tend to use interchangeably, but they're a bit different. Cure comes from the Latin curare, which means to set right on a physical level. And that's important. That's about the medical things, the chemotherapy, the surgery, all the things we do in modern medicine. But healing comes from the Greek word halen, which means to restore to wholeness. It's about really being cognizant of the mind, the body, and the spirit. And that's really such a key to getting better. And that's why in my office, for instance, when people are receiving chemotherapy, I have aromatherapy in the office with either different scents like sandalwood or lavender. And those type of things really make people a lot more peaceful. I teach people deep breathing exercises. I have very pleasant music and nature sounds like waves and running water all through the office. And what it teaches people is even when they're going through a difficult time, they find they still have the capacity to be peaceful no matter what's happening. And my patients find that very, very empowering to know that they can have that regardless of what's happening. It really lessens the anxiety. And we know from the field called psychoneuroimmunology that anxiety and worry depresses every aspect of our immune systems, most importantly the part of our immune system that's responsible for preventing cancer or a recurrence of cancer. Next slide. Now, a lot of my patients are told by different doctors, well, if you're in the middle of chemotherapy, make sure you don't have any antioxidants. And people come in and they say, well, Dr. Gaynor, what am I supposed to eat? Because every fruit, every vegetable that exists has antioxidants in it, which is true. And there are many clinical studies that have shown very powerful antioxidants did not alter the efficacy of chemotherapy. And there was a study that looked at very potent synthetic antioxidant called amifostine, which protects against a toxic form of chemo in terms of it doing kidney or nerve damage. That did nothing to lessen the efficacy of the chemotherapy. There is a natural product, which is a tripeptide or protein, called glutathione or GSH. This we use very commonly before chemotherapy, mainly in colon cancer and ovarian cancer, and it's been found that it decreases the neurologic side effects of the chemo with no reduction in the efficacy of the chemo, and it actually enhances the survival in ovarian cancer patients. And so if you don't have any antioxidants, it means you have to get rid of every fruit and every vegetable, all of which contain nutrients that are critically important for your immune system, critically important for life. So I think this really needs to be put in a quite different perspective. Next slide. It's very important for everybody to know about detoxifying enzymes. As it relates to breast cancer, there was a study published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute in 1998 by Kathy Helsauer from Johns Hopkins. She looked at the detoxifying enzyme ability of patients with and without breast cancer. And what she found was is women with the lowest levels of the most important detoxifying enzyme had a fourfold increased risk of breast cancer. So many people have genetically a lower level, but we know that there are nutrients such as foods that contain vitamin C, retinoids, carotenoids like the yellow vegetables, the green leafy vegetables, as I mentioned already, garlic, fish oil, turmeric, that all on a genetic level increase our body's production of detoxifying enzymes. This is truly at the level of gene therapy. We think of gene therapy probably as something that's going to be available in 100 years, but the fact is all of you are doing gene therapy every day based on the food that you're putting in your body. Next slide, please. Then vitamin D. Every single person should know their vitamin D levels, specifically the 25-hydroxyvitamin D. It's a simple blood test. It's a membrane-bound antioxidant, and low levels are linked to a poorer outcome in breast cancer. There was a very important paper published in 2008 where they looked at women that had had breast cancer, and they found that women that were deficient in vitamin D had a 94% higher chance of developing metastatic or spread of the cancer, and a 73% greater chance of dying than patients with intermediate or high levels of vitamin D. So all of you should know the vitamin D. Now, the most vitamin D you could really get, and even if you're eating a good diet with a lot of salmon and yogurt and dairy products, is about 350 units. About the least you need to get your level up to sufficient levels is a minimum of 1,000 or 2,000 units. But you shouldn't guess about it. Have your doctor measure your 25-hydroxyvitamin D so you'll know exactly how much to take. Next slide, please. Then it's very interesting. A lot of people think, well, if I have bad genes, what can I do? But there was a very interesting study about the BRCA mutation. That's the breast cancer mutation. And this is something that's really revolutionizing cancer. Only about 8% of all breast cancer is related to a BRCA mutation. But if they have it, they have an 82% lifetime risk of breast or ovarian cancer. Dr. Mary Claire King looked at old serum samples going way back prior to 1940 and after. And she found that the risk of breast cancer was only 24% if you had a BRCA mutation if you were born before 1940, but 67% if you were born after 1940. Same for the ovarian cancer. It was twice as high for BRCA1 carriers and 23% higher for BRCA2 carriers if they were born after 1940. After 1940 is when there was this huge influx into the environment and our society of plastic residues, of dioxin, of pesticides, of herbicides, of mercury. So this is when the planet really started being polluted. So we know there's a gene-environment interaction, and we know that environmental toxins make bad genes worse, but we also know that various nutrients can turn off a lot of those genes. Next slide. Then, as far as soy isoflavones, there's a lot of confusion about soy. This was a study presented in 2005 on postmenopausal breast cancer patients. And what they did is they biopsied the opposite breast of where the cancer was and measured breast cell proliferation in women that were receiving concentrated soy isoflavones versus a placebo or a sugar pill for 1 year. They found that the soy had no effect on increasing breast cell proliferation, and they even suggested a beneficial effect. Next slide. There was a very important study called WINS, or the Women's Intervention Study, and this was published in 2006. They looked at 2,400 women that had early breast cancer. They put half the women on a low-fat diet, low in saturated fat, less than 20%, versus control. At about 6 years, there were 22% fewer deaths in women on the low-fat diet. With the estrogen receptor negative patients, there was a 66% reduction in mortality. So it's very important both for prevention and if you've had breast cancer to eat a diet low in saturated fat. Next slide. Now, we've talked about glycemic index and having a low sugar. There is a drug that's about 60 years old called metformin. And metformin originally came from the French lilac, which is an herb that had been used in European folk medicine for about 300 years. And we've known for years that diabetics who were on metformin had 40% less cancer overall, 56% less breast cancer, and 62% less pancreatic cancer than ones not treated with metformin. And there was an interesting study quite by accident published in a large cancer journal about 2 years ago. They were looking at women with very large breast cancers that were too large to have any surgery. In that case, the women needed chemotherapy to try and shrink it down to make it operable. All these were diabetic women. Some were on insulin, some were on metformin, some were on other agents. What they found quite by accident is the women that happened to be on metformin had a threefold increased pathologic complete remission rate compared to all the other women, which means when the doctor went in to do the surgery, there was no cancer left, even under the microscope. And we know that this inhibits a lot of enzymes cancer cells need to grow, and it also lowers insulin-like growth factor. That's why a lot of doctors I know, myself included, take a low dose of metformin every day, just preventatively. Next slide. Then the impact of stress and health, I won't get into the studies so much on this, but stress affects every aspect of your immune system. It affects your cardiovascular system. It affects your endocrine system. And we know from a study that was published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, they look at women recovering from breast cancer, and they found women with the most stress and the most depression had the most depression of their part of their immune system called natural killer cells that's responsible for preventing a recurrence of the cancer. So in summary, there is a lot that integrative medicine and complementary medicine has to offer everybody, both people who've had cancer and people that want to avoid getting cancer. And I think the biggest breakthroughs of the last 10 years and the next 25 years are going to be in teaching people and allowing people how not to get cancer in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gaynor. It is truly a privilege to listen to you, and I suspect that many of our listeners will be speaking with their own treatment teams about the information that you shared this evening. Also, at a time when emotions are high, I think that your message of feeling peaceful is a very powerful one, so thank you for that.
Yes.
Our next speaker is Lisa Goldberg. She is a registered dietitian and a certified dietetic nutritionist since 1998. She has been working with breast cancer patients for the past 12 years. Lisa received her master's in nutrition at New York University and interned at the American Health Foundation and Beth Israel Medical Center. From 1999 to 2007, she worked at Memorial Sloan Kettering's Outpatient Breast Center as the clinical nutrition specialist. Lisa has been involved in several clinical research projects involving nutrition and breast cancer, both within Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and as a part of national multi-center trials. She works with women and men of all ages diagnosed with breast cancer or those at risk for breast cancer. Lisa also educates these patients on the nutrition guidelines before, during, and after treatment. She has also volunteered for and presented at the American Cancer Society, Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation, Greater New York Dietetic Association, as well as Charcheret. Before leaving Memorial Sloan Cancer Center to pursue a private practice, she co-authored a nutrition booklet regarding nutrition and breast cancer care. In addition, she has also earned her certificate in training in adult weight management and currently works in private practice counseling patients with breast cancer and weight issues. So, Lisa, welcome back to Charcheret. The proverbial floor is yours.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back. So what I'll be talking about today is how we're going to integrate nutrition and exercise with a focus on your breast health. And over the next 10 to 15 minutes, we're going to touch upon some of the things that Dr. Gaynor talked about with nutrition, and then we're going to address some of the other issues. If we can go to the next slide. So the topics for discussion are going to be obesity and weight gain, how or does body weight play a role on your breast health. We're going to talk about how to design a healthy diet, the role of fat and breast cancer. We'll be reviewing the results of the Women's Intervention Nutrition Study, which Dr. Gaina also talked about. We're also going to touch on sizing up servings. When designing a healthy diet, knowing appropriate portion sizes do matter. I'm also going to address healthy cooking tips and the impact of alcohol on breast cancer, as well as the role of phytoestrogens in breast cancer and some of the new data that has come out, which, again, I know Dr. Gaina has reviewed it, so we might be able to skim over some of that. And then we're going to review a little bit of the importance of exercise. The next slide. So is there a link between diet and breast cancer? If dietary factors are involved in the development of breast cancer, this is important to establish, because these are potentially modifiable, whereas most known risk factors for occurrence of breast cancer are not modifiable. If we can go to the next slide. So given the fact that gender, age of which you get your period, pregnancy, hormone replacement therapy, and prior breast cancer are non-modifiable risk factors for breast cancer, one of the areas that nutrition can play a role is in alcohol consumption, physical inactivity, obesity and weight gain, and diet itself. All of these risk factors seem to have one common link and thread, and that's estrogen, which I know Dr. Gaynor has touched on before also. And knowing that estrogen can influence breast cancer through effects on cell proliferation and DNA damage, as well as promotion of cancer growth, how does lifestyle change and diet fit into that? So if we can just go to the next slide. What I just want to review a little bit is the current weight trends in the United States. Research has shown that obesity has been linked to several diseases such as heart disease and diabetes and some cancers, including breast cancer. And as the trends towards obesity and overweight increase, we have also seen a trend in the rates of these diseases. What's staggering to me, and, you know, when I looked at this a few years ago, our rates have increased dramatically. Less than half of U.S. adults are at a healthy weight. Two-thirds of U.S. adults are overweight. That's incredible. Not nearly a half of U.S. Adults are obese. And for some, being overweight is subjective. However, in a clinical practice, we have specific criteria to define overweight, obese, and morbid obesity. One tool that we use is called the Body Mass Index. So if we can just look at that next slide, know your BMI. The body mass index is basically a measure that we look at, and it shows your weight relative to your height. And it's a tool that we use to help interpret chronic disease. And to help calculate your BMI, find your height in the left-hand column and then look for your weight in the grid area. The number on the top row where your height and weight meet is your body mass index. So when you go to interpret that number, underweight would be below 18.5. Normal weight would be between that 18.5 and 25. Overweight is considered a BMI of 25 to 30. And anything above 30 is considered obese, and further than that would be morbid obesity. Next slide. So over the past few decades, the rate of breast cancer incidence has increased. Some of this increase can be attributed to the increase in awareness, screening, and early detection, but we also have to look at the impact that the rising incidence of obesity has on breast cancer risk. Estrogen gets stored in our adipose tissue, which is our fat stores, and knowing that estrogen can stimulate breast cancer, being lean can lower the amount of adipose tissue, in turn lowering overall estrogen levels. Clearly, this is where diet can make a huge difference. Next slide. Many patients gain weight, unfortunately, after their diagnosis and treatment for breast cancer. This occurs in over half of breast cancer patients receiving adjuvant therapy, no matter what stage of disease. On average, weight gain can range anywhere from 5 to 15 pounds in breast cancer patients, and I usually tell my patients that, you know, if you maintain your weight during treatment, it's almost like a 10-pound weight loss. But ideally, you know, you don't want to be gaining excessive amounts of weight. Premenopausal women seem to gain more weight than postmenopausal women, and there are several reasons why weight gain can occur. Basically, especially in the premenopausal women, they may have an early onset of menopause, which tends to be treatment-related. There's a decrease in physical activity, which tends to be treatment-related because you're more fatigued. Increased food intake, in particular starchy foods. These foods can be helpful when you're nauseous, but they can also carry more calories. And then combination therapy, chemotherapy, seems to lead to increase in weight gain versus single-agent therapy. Use of steroids during treatment. Steroids lead to an increase in appetite, fluid retention, and even mood changes. And therefore, you know, depression plays a role in that because a lot of times when somebody's depressed, they might be eating more. And changes in body composition have also been reported in patients who receive chemotherapy. I hear a lot about that tire around the abdomen or that thickening in the abdominal wall. A lot of that has to do with hormonal shifts and also the weight gain. And if we look at the next slide where we look at the distribution of body fat and breast cancer risk, abdominal weight gain seems to carry more risk of disease than weight over the hips, the buttocks, and the lower extremities. And that central body fat distribution is associated with multiple hormonal and metabolic changes, including insulin resistance and higher estrogen in fat tissue. So what do we do with this information? Basically, the short-term goal during treatment is to maintain your weight while you're going through treatment or perhaps lose a few pounds if needed. But major fluctuations in your weight, either weight loss or weight gain, may alter your current treatment regimen. So that's really not ideal. Once treatment is completed, the long-term goal is to achieve and maintain a healthy body weight. So what we're going to talk about is how do we get there. Let's go to the next slide. Many Americans are really confused about what food group to eat, what should they eat, what should they avoid, what's considered healthy. Even the food guide pyramid is quite confusing. And there are so many different diets on the market right now, and one is about eating bread, one says don't eat bread. Part of the confusion stems from popular weight loss programs that have been promoted that were high-fat, low-carb, or high-protein, low-fat, low-carb. And what ends up happening is many people tend to just follow a little bit from each diet regimen and inadvertently gain weight because they're eating too many calories overall. So basically, it doesn't tend to be about the specific nutrient, meaning the protein, the fat, or the carb. It's that you're just eating too much of it. So if we move into the next slide, the first step when designing a healthy diet is really to determine your calorie count. It has been reported that maintaining a healthy weight is one of the most important things you can do to reduce your risk for cancer. The three strategies for both cancer prevention and weight loss are similar, such as strategies for cancer prevention, eat mostly plant-based foods, which are low in energy density, be physically active, and maintain a healthy weight via steps 1 and 2, as well as reducing your portion size. Strategies for weight loss are eat a greater proportion of plant-based foods, which are low in energy density, be physically active, and reduce your portion size. So before you even determine what foods to eat, it's important to determine how many calories you can consume. Caloric needs will vary according to the level of physical activity and whether weight reduction, maintenance, or gain is desired. In general, most American adults lead to a sedentary lifestyle, so that for a 51-year-old woman with light activity or sedentary would require approximately 1,600 calories for weight maintenance. And to lose weight, calories would need to be decreased and or activity level would be increased. And the next slide is basically just a little review of, it's another quick method of how to calculate out your calories. So if we move on to the next slide, we'll see that the American Institute for Cancer Research has created what's called the New American Plate. And what that plate demonstrates is how we should be dividing up our meal plan for the day. So basically what you're looking at is two-thirds or more of your diet should be vegetables and fruits and whole grains and beans. And the other third of your plate or less is going to come from animal proteins. And, you know, by following a meal plan like this, ultimately your caloric intake is going to be a lot lower. If we move on to the next slide, in concert with the dietary recommendations that the American Institute for Cancer Research is promoting, the USDA is now promoting their new dietary guidelines. And as you can see, there is a large emphasis on plant foods, such as fruit, vegetables, whole grains, and within these guidelines there's also an emphasis on physical activity. And we're going to see later on how physical activity and breast cancer play a role. While these recommendations are not specific for breast cancer, they do provide a framework for achieving and maintaining a healthy body weight. So if we move on to the next slide, the food label is a useful tool in determining the calories and nutrients in your diet. A nutrition fact label should be on most packaged foods, and the top of the label lists serving size and number of servings per package. The nutritional content on the label is based on one serving size. If the portion you consume is bigger or smaller than that serving size listed, you should make the necessary calculations to determine the nutritional value. Be sure to look at serving size on the nutrition facts label. Values on the label vary with each food item and between products. In this example, there are two servings in the sample nutrition label, which means that if you ate the whole entire container, you'd have about 520 calories, 26 grams of fat, and so on and so forth, because you'd have to double all the other nutrients. So just a quick slide sort of demonstrating how confusing our food labels are. You know, this chocolate bar says it's only 75 calories, but really it has 650-plus servings. So you eat the whole thing, and, you know, obviously that's an excessive amount of calories. If we move on to the next slide, you know, we talk about serving sizes that play an important role when designing a healthful diet. The following is an example of serving sizes for fruits and vegetables. Keep in mind, this should be the cornerstone of your diet. So, again, half your plate is going to be fruit and vegetables. Portion of those of your plate is going to be whole grains. Next slide, we're going to look at, so with the 2010 dietary guidelines that recommend 4 to 5 cups of fruits and vegetables, these foods contain a wide range of vitamins and minerals, but they also contain the substance called phytochemicals. And the phytochemicals are natural components found in plant foods which may provide health benefits. They are found in fruits, in vegetables, in legumes, in grains, and phytochemicals in foods are associated with a reduced risk of cancer and seem to have anti-cancer properties. They may lower cancer risk by preventing damage to DNA. They may compete with estrogens, enhance immune function, as well as help rid the body of carcinogens. However, more research still needs to be done in this area, but nevertheless, eating these foods are going to be very beneficial. The best way to consume phytochemicals is to include a wide variety of plant foods in your diet. Eating the whole food will provide fiber, vitamins, minerals, as well as the phytochemical, and this may all provide some kind of synergistic effect on your health. When choosing fruits and vegetables, make sure they're rich in color, make sure there's variety. And just one phytochemical I do want to touch on is in that dark green area, and that's called the indole-3-carbinone. And there's been a lot of attention amongst breast cancer patients because it's been shown that indole-3-carbinone may block DNA damage and decrease the effects of estrogen in the body. And the National Institute of Health is now sponsoring a study looking at the benefits of indole-3-carbinone on breast cancer risk. So where you can find it is in broccoli, in spinach, in kale, and I know Dr. Gaina had addressed that before, but I want to emphasize that again, that broccoli, spinach, and kale are great foods that do contain this phytochemical. So, again, important things to incorporate into your diet. If we move on to the next slide, we're going to touch on the serving sizes for grains and starch. And when you're choosing your starches and your grains, try to choose foods that are whole grains, because when you see something that says whole grain, it contains more fiber. And fiber is really an important part of a healthy diet, but it's also important to control diabetes, lower cholesterol, improve bowel function, and also combine to estrogen and potentially remove that from the body. So whole grains, which include the entire grain seed, are higher in fiber and better for you than refined sugars and refined flours. So just the next slide is another example of looking at a food label. And as you can see, it says they're both different types of wheat bread. One is whole wheat bread. The other one is wheat bread. Whole wheat bread has 3 grams of fiber, which really you don't want to, you want to make sure that any type of grain you're having has at least 3 grams of fiber in it or more. And in the right-hand side, that wheat bread has less than 1 gram of fiber. So clearly, it can be confusing when the facts, when the nutrition fact labels are not read properly. Ideally, women should be consuming 25 grams of fiber a day, and that can be achieved through fruits, through your vegetables, and your whole grains. So it's really, it's quite possible to get that through your diet, and, you know, so incorporating mostly plant-based foods in your diet is going to be most beneficial. If we go on to the next slide, and I know Dr. Gaina had talked about the study results of the Women's Intervention Nutrition Study, and just to sort of reiterate that there was definitely, the study looked at, I should say, women who followed a low-fat diet, which was 20 to 30 grams of fat, and those women who did follow the 20 to 30 grams of fat did seem to have a lower incidence of breast cancer recurrence, and especially in the estrogen receptor negative women. And one of the things that the study did find was that women were able to successfully follow a low-fat diet. And so it just provides more reason that a low-fat diet should be part of a healthy lifestyle. So, you know, this is one key component that we should be looking at in terms of diet modification is following that low-fat diet. That doesn't mean adding in high refined sugars. It just means choosing foods that are lower in fat. And one area that we can do that, if we move to the next slide, is choosing the right type of fat also. So there are really, you have your unsaturated fats, which are consist of your monounsaturated and your polyunsaturated. And those are your health, considered your healthy fats. They don't have much impact on your cholesterol. Those are olive oil, canola oil, nuts, olives, avocado. Those you're going to find as monounsaturated fats. Your polyunsaturated fat, which consists of your omega-3 fatty acids, which you're going to see in salmon, in halibut, in sardines, in almonds, in walnuts, are also very, very healthy, and as Dr. Gaina said, can also help with immune function. Saturated fat is really an area that you want to perhaps have a limit on because it does have a fattier content. It impacts your cholesterol levels a little bit more, and there you had to sort of decrease your saturated fat would be to take the skin off of the chicken, eliminate whole milk, perhaps use skim milk or reduced fat milk, eliminate the processed foods. Packaged goods tend to have more saturated fat, and the same thing with those trans fats. The trans fats were very popular because they increase the shelf life of a food product, so manufacturers, left a lot of their products with trans fat in there. But as the media has gotten more attention about how trans fat are not healthy for you, most manufacturers have started removing trans fats from their products. But be sure to look at those nutrition facts, the nutrition fact labels, because they will identify foods that do contain trans fats. Also, an important fact about fat is it does provide significant amounts of calories, 9 calories per gram, versus a protein or a carbohydrate, which are only 4 calories. The recommended total fat intake to try to stick to is about 20% of your calories, which might mean below that 30 grams per day on a 1,600-calorie diet. And based on the results of the Women's Intervention Nutrition Study, 20 to 30 calories a day was very doable, and patients were able to follow that. When we move into the next slide, and it's talking about animal protein and how to choose a healthy animal protein, you have fish, which tends to be leaner and typically has more of the omega-3 fatty acids. But one of the areas you need to worry about is mercury. And the fish that tend to have a higher amount of mercury are shark and swordfish and mackerel and tilefish and even and tuna. So make sure when you're choosing fish that things like salmon and catfish and sardines are all typically lower in mercury content, and those are all very low-calorie, low-fat choices. When you choose chicken, you want to make sure you take the skin off of it. The skin is the area that carries the most amount of fat. Same thing with dairy when looking at dairy products. skim milk is obviously going to have less calories and less fat, as well as with cheese, low-fat cheese, fat-free cheese are going to have low amounts of calories in it as well. When you look at your meat, you want to choose meats that are lean. It's going to be labeled loin or round, top round, eye of round, round tip, sirloin. All of these are considered lower in fat. Same thing with lamb, whether it's a leg or a loin, those are going to be your leanest. Ideally, avoid luncheon meats, hot dogs, any kind of processed foods. Those tend to have a lot more saturated fat in there and a lot more calories. So when we move into the next slide, here are just some healthy cooking tips. Bake, boil, grill, and poach are always going to be better ways to prepare your food. Do not bread or batter or fry your food. And if you're going to sauté or you stir-fry, you might want to get a spritzer and add some olive oil in there and use that as a mister instead of pouring on olive oil into your dish. Remove the skin and visible fat on any of meat or chicken when you're cooking. It's always best to make soup the day beforehand and refrigerate it, and then you can skim off that congealed fat. Use a rack when roasting or broiling to allow fat to drip away. Use the nonstick pan or a cooking spray when stir-frying. And as an alternate to high-fat marinades, try lemon and lime and flavored vinegars. And these are other good options to marinate your food. So when we move into the next slide, we're going to touch a little bit upon alcohol. And, you know, this is an area that there may be a link between breast cancer risk and alcohol. There's been several studies that have been looking at the effect of alcohol in breast cancer. Alcohol may alter circulating estrogen levels by two possible pathways. It may upregulate estrogen receptors, meaning it may make more estrogen receptors and therefore increase the sensitivity of tumor cells to the same level of estrogen, or it may increase circulating estrogen levels. Again, increased exposure to estrogen increases one's risk for breast cancer. Too much alcohol is also linked to liver disease, inflammation of the stomach and pancreas, high blood pressure, and increased risk for other cancers. So in terms of risk, the type of alcohol is really irrelevant. Increased drinking leads to increased risk. In addition, alcohol is a source of empty calories. Alcohol can range from approximately 100 calories to 300 calories or more, depending on the type of drink, if any juice or mixers or added beverages are added, and the serving size will have an impact. And women can really reduce their risk of breast cancer by limiting their intake of alcohol to one serving or less per day. And a serving of alcohol would be considered 4 ounces of wine or champagne, 12 ounces of beer, which is 150 calories, and 1.5 ounces of hard liquor, which is about 100 calories. So really monitor the portion sizes there. Now we're going to move into the next slide, which is going to address the role of physical activity and breast cancer. And as with alcohol, physical activity has been investigated as a disease-modifying factor. The relationship between physical activity and breast cancer incidence has been extensively studied, but most studies indicate physical activity and women have a lower risk of breast cancer incidence. However, the amount of risk reduction achieved through physical activity varies widely, really between 20 and 80%. And because many of these studies rely on surveys and patient recalls, physical activity can be difficult to objectively quantify, which might explain the wide variation in study results. So in general, although a lifetime of regular, vigorous activity is thought to be the greatest benefit, women who increase their physical activity after menopause also experience a reduced risk compared to those who are inactive women, more motivation to exercise. Most studies suggest 30 to 60 minutes per day of moderate to high intensity physical activity is associated with a reduction in breast cancer risk. researchers have suggested several biological mechanisms to explain the relationship between physical activity and breast cancer development. One is physical activity may prevent tumor development by lowering hormone levels, particularly in the premenopausal woman. Also, physical activity may lower insulin levels and insulin-like growth factor, improving immune function response and assisting with weight maintenance to avoid a high body mass index and excess body fat. Okay, so let's go on to the next slide. And I know that Dr. Gaynor did talk a little bit about soy, so I'd like to touch on that as well. The risk of breast cancer varies substantially throughout the world. Research about the effects of soy on breast cancer reduction has been mixed. Much of it has come from observing population groups such as in Japan, whose population eats far more soy and began eating soy at a much younger age than people in Western countries. In fact, the average woman living in East Asia eats about 10 times the quantity of whole soy foods than the average woman in the United States. Yet Asian women have a lower rate of hormone receptor positive breast cancer than women in the U.S. The soy debate, as we refer to it, I guess, and its possible connection to breast cancer is complicated by other factors. Most women living in Asia depend on soy as their main source of protein. They consume only small amounts of animal protein, such as beef and chicken. And also, compared to the average woman in the United States, the average Asian woman eats far more vegetables, has a healthier BMI, is more physically active, and is less likely to consume an excessive amount of alcohol. So all of these factors do add up to produce a healthier lifestyle and lower overall risk of breast cancer in Asian women living in Asia. But what's interesting to note is that Asian American women have an increased breast cancer incidence than Asian women living in Asia. Many experts think that the Western lifestyle might play a role in this higher rate. However, what do we actually know about soy and how does it affect the patient with breast cancer? So if we go on to this next slide, soy has been referred to as a phytoestrogen, a plant estrogen, and the active component in phytoestrogens are their phytochemicals, which are the isoflavones, the lignans, and the chemestins. The predominant food source for isoflavones are soy, for lignin is the flaxseed, and chemestin is your alfalfa. And the chemical structure of isoflavin and the chemical structure of estrogen are very similar. An important question is, since these structures are so similar, can eating soy pose a problem for the breast cancer patient? If we move on to the next slide, as you can see, most of the population studies suggested soy has a protective benefit against breast cancer, and they looked at traditional soy foods of the Asian diet. So you're talking about tofu and tempeh and the soybean and miso, as opposed to, on this next slide, the American's version of soy food. And as you can see here, that soy foods have become increasingly popular amongst health-conscious individuals over the past decade. However, while Americans think they're being healthy by consuming lower-carbohydrate products or meat alternatives and protein shakes, many don't realize they're consuming more calories and concentrated phytoestrogens. These types of processed soy food is very different than the traditional soy food and the traditional soy food isoflavin content that you find in the Asian diet. As one of the effects of patients watching these carbohydrate intakes, there is often an increase in their soy intake, whether intentional or unintentional. Many new low-carbohydrate products saturating the supermarket shelves right now contain soy-based ingredients such as soy fiber, soy flour, soy proteins, and these actually help to increase protein content and fiber content and overall decrease the whole carbohydrate content. The American's version of soy food cannot be compared to the quality of the Asian soy food, which brings us back to the soy debate. Is soy helpful or harmful for women with breast cancer? Most recently, an observational study at a Vanderbilt Medical Center found that soy food may actually be helpful for the breast cancer patient as part of a healthy lifestyle. However, this cannot be directly generalized to soy supplements or processed soy food, as supplements may differ from soy foods in both their type and amount of isoflavones. Also, there are still concerns that isoflavones may alter the effect of tamoxifen, making it less effective since both tamoxifen and isoflavone do bind to estrogen receptors. While these study results are very promising, this is still just an observational study, which means that people were reflecting on their habits rather than it being a controlled study designed to specifically test their intake of soy. With that in mind, there is an active study being conducted at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and the study's title is The Effect of Soy Supplementation on Cellular Markers in Normal and Cancerous Breast Tissue, a Randomized Placebo-Controlled Trial. The purpose of the study is to determine the effect of soy protein on normal and cancerous breast tissue. The results from the study will come out, be published probably by the end of 2012. In the meantime, most health organizations suggest consuming whole soy foods as part of a low-fat, plant-based, calorie-controlled diet. If we look at the next slide...
Lisa, I'm also just going to jump in because we're going to need to start wrapping up.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right.
That's okay. No, this is wonderful. But
okay.
No. Keep...
Let's cruise past this next slide because this is something that, you know, it could easily be looked at. And if we just look at our take-home point on soy, soy foods are an excellent source of protein and can be a good option for meals without meat. Soy contains many phytochemicals. Some have weak estrogen activity. They also have compounds in soy that have antioxidants and other helpful properties. So basically what the American Cancer Society and American Institute for Cancer Research are suggesting is as part of a low-fat, calorie-controlled diet, a moderate amount of soy, about 3 servings a day, which is consistent with what the Asian diet consumes, is perfectly fine. But at this point, to avoid concentrated forms of phytoestrogens and supplements, as they may differ from soy foods in both the type and the amount of isoflavones. So now we're quickly going to put it all together. So on this next slide, basically what we're looking at, just to sort of highlight everything, is you want to achieve and maintain a healthy body weight. So you want to look to have your body mass index under 25. You want to monitor those portions. Look at your serving sizes. And when you monitor your portions, you automatically are controlling your calories. Exercise is clearly very, very important for overall health and certainly for breast health. At least 30 to 60 minutes of physical activity a day is important, and that's on top of your regular daily activity. So that's in addition to. And if we go on to the next slide, a low-fat diet is certainly indicated, 20% of calories from fat, less than 30 grams of fat a day, mostly plant-based diet, again, 3 servings of soy per day as part of a healthy diet is okay. Third of your plate from animal-based foods, make it lean, you know, whether it be fish, whether it be chicken without the skin, those are good choices. And the next slide, again, focusing on your fruits, your vegetables, and your whole grains. You want to make sure you're getting half of your plate should be your fruit and vegetables, 3 servings of whole grain a day, and 25 grams of more fiber. And by consuming those foods, you'll be able to achieve the 25 grams of fiber. And the final slide is limit your alcohol, if at all. Basically, calories from alcohol add up, and alcohol can increase estrogen levels. The goal is to drink about less than 1 serving per day. So the take-home message is what's healthy for women with breast cancer is also healthy for the general population. You cannot go wrong by achieving and maintaining a healthy body weight. Okay, so I think we can wrap up here.
Lisa, thank you, really. We are grateful that you've agreed to share your wisdom once again with our Sorcheret listeners, and you've managed to take a charged topic of nutrition and weight and present it with such clarity. And we also very much appreciate the many tips and guidelines that you offered this evening. I want to just remind all of our listeners that the presenter slides will be available on the Sorcheret website. So I certainly encourage you to revisit all of these slides to help you to go back to some of the information that was offered this evening. Our final speaker is Sherry Lebed Davis. She is one of the foremost authorities, trainers, and presenters on the use of movement and therapeutic exercise for the healing and quality of life issues after cancer, lymphedema, and chronic illness. She is the founder and co-developer, along with Drs. Mark and Joel Lebed, of Healthy Steps, moving you to a better health with the Lebed Method, an internationally acclaimed movement and exercise program. Sherry has been seen in People Magazine, Health Magazine, Oxygen, MAM, Coping, Cure, Spa, New York Times, Seattle Times, LA Times, and more. She has appeared on the Today Show, Lifetime Live, The Nightly News, BBC, and many more. Sherry was awarded Seattle Most Inspiring Breast Cancer Survivor, and Healthy Steps was a finalist in the Shine a Light contest sponsored by American Express and Universal Studios. She has received the Congress Award in Dance Excellence for working with children and recognized by major cancer and lymphedema groups. She has authored a book, two DVDs, and a music CD. Sherry is a thriver of breast cancer, lymphedema, and hepatitis C. While continuing her quest to motivate and inspire others to remember that surviving is important, but thriving is elegant. Sherry has so graciously offered to serve as Shoshera peer supporter, and we are truly grateful that she has joined our Shoshera community. Sherry?
Thank you, Sherrod. That was wonderful. I really appreciate that. That was great. I want to go really fast because I know we're late, and I want to be able to leave room for questions and answers. So there's a couple of photos that you can see on the front. The history of the program, if we can go to the next slide, I'll just go over that really fast. It started in 1980. My mother developed breast cancer, and my brothers were doing breast cancer surgery at the time, and they weren't happy with any of the women and their physical accomplishments after they survived breast cancer. At the time, they were called victims. And so my mother developed breast cancer in 1980. She developed frozen shoulder, lymphedema, and emotionally she was extremely depressed. So my parents used to be professional ballroom dancers, and although my brothers are physician surgeons, we all were raised in a household of dance and music. And I used to be a professional dancer and owned some dance studios at the time. We decided to help my mother, and that was the main start of our program. We developed a program. I would do some dance movements, and they would tell me what was clinically best to help heal our mother. And so we developed this program. Dr. Robert Summers, who was the cancer director at Albert Einstein Medical Center, was so overwhelmed by my mother's progress, he wanted this program in his hospital for every single breast cancer survivor. And those of you on the call who are old enough to know that in 1980, alternative medicine was not too accepted by many hospitals. And so by 1986, the program had proved so overwhelmingly successful that Dr. Summers ordered us to do our first study. And we did the study. It was published in the National Physical Therapy Journal in 1986. And it showed that our program increased energy levels, decreased depression, stress, and anxiety, increased range of motion and flexibility. And so the program grew, and I ended up moving to the West Coast in 1986. I developed breast cancer. And my brothers decided that since the program helped me so much and I wanted to devote my life to other breast cancer survivors, that became my mission, and my goal in life was to make this program for everyone. And so, long and short of the story, we train trainers all over the world. I have trainers, and we're in 14 countries and have well over 1,000 instructors. And so that was the beginning, was with my mother. It was the first hospital-based program in the United States, the first with a published study. It's in currently in 14 countries and 900 hospitals. And I'll take the next slide. Our published studies, which I'm not going to go into at length, but if anybody wants a copy, I'd be more than happy to send it. Our studies basically showed, and there's quite a few of them here, that our program promotes quality of life, as I said, decreases stress, depression, anxiety, helps with balance, increases energy levels, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful program. It's done with great music, can be done sitting or standing. It is so easy to do. And that was one of the most successful things about it. My brothers and I wanted to bring back the women's sensuality and sexuality to them. because as being a breast cancer survivor myself, sometimes we lose that. And as it was stated, we need the exercise so badly for healing and to encourage our future and decrease our chances of breast cancer again. So the program does so many different things. It helps people exercise who can't do perhaps a yoga program or a Pilates program, but yet they need to exercise and aren't that exercise motivated. This is an amazing motivational program. Can I have the next slide? The one thing that we did when I developed lymphedema in 1999, my brothers and I went back to the drawing board, and we developed exercises for helping to reduce swelling from lymphedema. Now, it also turned out to help work the lymphatic system, and if any of you know, the lymphatic system is a very major part of our immune system. And so we found that particular exercises done in a certain order and in a certain way help open the major drains of the lymphatic system and get the lymph fluid flowing the way it needs to do. I wanted to leave you with an exercise that you could all do at home, and I actually gave Adina the lymphatic opening, a chart to email to any of you that want it. But we found that helping to open up the major drains in the lymphatic system, you needed to have smooth, resistive exercises that pump and release. And so one of the major parts and the largest part where you have the most lymphatic nodes, lymph nodes, are in your lung area, around the lung area and the abdomen below the diaphragm. And so opening up the major drains in the thorax, located near the lungs, we developed a special breathing exercises that contracts and releases. Can I have the next slide, please? Blowing bubbles. So that's your homework assignment for all of you. Get yourself a jar of bubbles and sit there and blow bubbles. Well, not only in our studies did we find that this helped open up the lymphatic system, open up those major drains, help increase lung capacity, but it also helped decrease stress and anxiety. So for those of you who are still at work, take your bubbles into your little stalls at work and start blowing bubbles when you feel depressed or stressed. But you will find if you can blow the bubbles for 5-10 minutes a day that you will start to feel so much better. Can I have the next slide, please? That is a couple of pictures there of our program. It's really easy to do and lots of fun. And the other picture there is a photo of my brother and I. His name is Dr. Mark Labed, and he is our medical director on our program now. So every exercise and every movement is put to him to make sure that it's medically driven and safe. So we really feel that our program is totally safe, easy to do, and has a direct influence on how you're going to feel and improve your health and wellness. And the final thought that I want to leave you with on the next slide is that surviving is important, but thriving is elegant. And never see the glass half full, half empty, rather. Always see it half full. And I think, Sharad, that I just wanted to finish really fast. I don't know if there's anything else you would like me to cover, but I appreciate you putting me in there because I feel exercise is so important. Like Dr. Gaynor and Lisa said, it's an excellent component to wellness and quality of life for those who have had cancer and need to do the exercising.
Sherry, thank you. And I do think that that's an important message because oftentimes we think of exercise really more as a physical modality. But I really do think that it certainly has an impact on emotional and spiritual health as well. And I think that it's important for all our participants to know that they can engage in exercise based on their own baselines and their energy levels and their abilities. So thank you, Sherry.
Thank you, Sharad, for having me.
Before we begin the question and answer portion of tonight's teleconference, I want to assure you that that your identity will remain anonymous should you decide to ask a question. We understand that some of the material discussed tonight may impact your medical treatment, and we encourage you to consult directly with your medical team. We also ask that you keep your questions broad in nature so that everyone on the call can benefit from the discussion. To pose a question to the panelists, please press star 1 on your phone or type your question into the chat box at the bottom right corner of your screen. Questions will be addressed in the order received. So I'm going to go ahead and pose a question to you, Dr. Gaynor, a question that came in prior to the teleconference this evening, and that is, it came from a caller who said, I am interested in learning more about holistic approaches to cancer prevention for BRCA carriers. What does integrative medicine offer? Conventional medical therapy suggests that removing the fallopian tubes and ovaries is the best way to go, but is anyone doing research on removal of fallopian tubes, ovaries, along with bioidentical hormone replacement therapy and or naturopathy pre and post salpingo-oophorectomy? So that's the first part of the question. I'll let you take that, and then there's a part two.
Well, I think that's an excellent question, and there is a tremendous amount that still needs to be done for both men and women who are BRCA mutation carriers. And the reason is, you know, we know that there are two major fields that are emerging. One is called nutritional genomics, and the other is called toxicogenomics. And those are two fields under a broader heading called epigenetics. Epi means above. So what epigenetics is the study of, it means above the genome, because we're all born with a certain complement of genes. But the fact of the matter is, what we're understanding now is that the expression of those genes can be modified by a host of factors, such as, you know, whether we're eating a high-fat diet, whether we're eating a lot of sugar, whether we're consuming a lot of alcohol or caffeine or other environmental toxins, or whether we're putting a lot of good things in our body. And so, you know, still, the best advice today is to talk to a genetics counselor, to talk with a physician, usually a breast surgeon, a medical oncologist, and a GYN oncologist, because the timing of whether to do a salpingo-oophorectomy, removing the fallopian tubes and the ovaries, is critical. And what we find, especially in a number of BRCA2 carriers, is even if we do scans, we do sonograms, we do CAT scans, there's still a very significant incidence of finding a very small, unidentifiable ovarian or fallopian tube cancer at the time of surgery that clearly could have spread. And even doing that, there may still be some residual cells left, so it's not 100% effective. But I think these are the kinds of questions, and I know most people are still quite reluctant to give estrogen replacement therapy after doing an oophorectomy in a BRCA positive patient.
Okay, and the follow-up to that, I guess, would be the caller wants to know, is there something that it can, either through natural interventions, nutrition, exercise, is there something that can perhaps turn the gene off to protect from cancerous growth if you're BRCA positive?
Well, it's not that black or white. So it's not like, you know, it's turned off or on. If we could do that, you know, somebody would probably win a Nobel Prize for that. But we're not there yet. But that being said, for instance, the data showing women born after 1940 and exposed to a lot of environmental toxins have an almost threefold risk of developing cancer with a BRCA mutation. So clearly, there are things that you can do to make your body stronger. Because we know that still there are a number of women with the BRCA mutation and men who never get cancer. And what's different about those people? And I suspect doing things like staying within 10% of your ideal body weight, having a lot of nutrients that increase your body's ability to rid itself of toxins, like things from the skin of red grapes, resveratrol, spices like turmeric and rosemary, a lot of omega-3 fatty acids from either fish, pumpkin seed, flaxseed. Those types of things, I think, are important interventions. Also, anti-inflammatory nutrients like N-acetylcysteine, things that can change your estrogen profile, like the cruciferous vegetables, all those can play a role. But it's not as black or white as just turning off the gene.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Gaynor. Lisa, a question came in. A woman said that she's complaining about a metallic taste that she's having. She doesn't know, perhaps maybe it's treatment related, but do you have any suggestions for her?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that can happen a lot with the Taxol treatment, if that's a part of the treatment she's on. You basically, spice your foods differently, add a little bit of lemon, keep your mouth moist. Use vinegar, sometimes a little bit spicy taste. If you have mouth sores, you don't want to have that much acidity in your diet. But if you don't have mouth sores, then spicing it up with some flavorful, marinades will definitely be helpful. Protein sometimes tastes a little funny, so that really requires being creative with either lemon or lime or vinegars. Those are really going to be helpful ways, and adding different spices.
Great, thank you. Sherry, I was wondering if you could briefly discuss the link maybe between laughter and breathing.
Yes, it's a great thing. Actually, it's part of the contract and release theory that we have and the resistance theory that we have in our program. It's like running a marathon, laughing. It releases endorphins and gets your endorphins and gets your spirit up and changes your depression and stress. And during our program, one of the theories that we have is we laugh through our entire program. It's very fun. We encourage laughing. We encourage singing. We encourage talking, and which creates the breathing. So the laughing, the breathing is so important to eliminate stress, anxiety, depression, and to also get the lymphatic system pumping.
Great. Thank you, Sherry. We are at 9:30, and I'm sure that there are many more questions. So we encourage you to send your questions to us at Sharsheret, and I'll give you that contact information in a moment. And we can certainly pass that along to our panelists and get you the responses. As we wrap up this evening, I'd like to thank all the speakers for so generously sharing their wisdom, their experience, and certainly their time with us this evening. Please be sure to complete the online evaluation form that you will receive in your email inbox tomorrow. Your feedback is very important to us. Tonight's program was a direct outcome from the feedback that we received from this year's annual evaluation. I encourage you to reach out to Sharsheret anytime for support and resources. Our contact information is on the slide, and you can reach us at 866-474-2774. And you can also reach us by on our website. There's contact information there. I encourage you to look at prior teleconferences that we've offered at www.sharsheret.org. And I invite all of you to visit our blog at sharsheret.blogspot.com and read about other experts, read about other women who have faced some of the difficult decisions that many of you have faced, and women who, as Sherry would say, are thriving. And I encourage you to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can go to YouTube and see some of the videos that we've posted as well. I want to thank all of you for joining us tonight as we explore the importance of holistic healing. We hope that tonight's teleconference inspired you to encourage you and to help you engage in healthy life practices and to help you find the right balance in the three realms of mind, body, and soul. So with that, we want to wish you all a good night.